The following podcast contains spoilers and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Criminal Adaptations, the show where we take a look at some of your favorite movies and the true crime stories that inspired them. I'm Ashley. I'm a clinical psychologist and forensic evaluator in the state of Oregon.
And I'm Remy. I spent over a decade in the film and television industry in Los Angeles, California. And what are we here to talk about, Ashley?
Today, we are here to talk about a movie I have never seen and one I didn't even know existed, Heavenly Creatures, with Melanie Lynskey and Kate Winslet, directed by Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame.
Yes, that is what we are doing today. I had never heard of this movie until actually a few years back. I was a very big fan of Kate Winslet, Melanie Lynskey, Peter Jackson, and I stumbled upon this film on IMDb that I had never heard of, and I sort of half-heartedly watched it. It was sort of like on in the background while I was doing other things, and I remember it being very weird and kind of surreal, but I really was not paying much attention. So this most recent watch was a brand new experience, I would say. And Ashley, you said you haven't seen it. We will need to watch this sometime. It is a very interesting film, to say the least.
You know how much I love Kate Winslet, so I am down for that.
Yes, Ashley is a unabashed lover of the film Titanic. You will probably get several references to the film Titanic during this podcast.
I will try my best to keep them at bay.
No harm, no foul. Titanic's a great movie. You tried to convince me that it was a true crime thing that we could do an episode on, but I had to put the squash on that one, unfortunately. I don't think Titanic quite falls under the true crime category.
I tried, dear listeners, I tried.
Well, are you ready to hear about the movie then, Ashley?
Yes, I can't wait. Tell me all about it.
Then let's get into it. Heavenly Creatures is a 1994 New Zealand biographical drama written by Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh, directed by Peter Jackson, and is the feature film debut of megastars Kate Winslet and Melanie Lynskey. Side note, Melanie Lynskey was very good in this season's Last of Us. Back on topic, screenwriter Fran Walsh had been interested in the case since childhood and was the one who initially brought the idea to Jackson, who at the time was primarily known for directing low-budget horror comedies. In a quote, she said, "I first came across it in the late 60s when I was 10 years old. The Sunday Times devoted two whole pages to the story with an accompanying illustration of the two girls. I was struck by the description of the dark and mysterious friendship that existed between them, by the uniqueness of the world the two girls had created for themselves."
I'm pretty surprised to hear that it was only a two-page article in the New York Times, because this case, the true case, happened in 1954, and at the time, it was New Zealand's most famous crime. There were reporters from all around the world that attended and covered this case. At this time in New Zealand, when this murder happened, in the early 1950s, there was only two or three murders in New Zealand per year. So the fact that this case involved two young girls really drew a lot of attention to it.
I know. All of my research did point to New Zealand being a very low crime, very peaceful place. I believe there's more sheep than people in New Zealand, which could contribute to the low crime rate.
Yeah, the city was a big sheep farming city.
Back to Heavenly Creatures, Jackson and Walsh started by researching the story through reading contemporary newspaper accounts of the trial, but found that many of the articles were far too sensationalized and decided early on that the focus of the story should be between the friendship between the two girls rather than the murder trial. Jackson stated in an interview, "The friendship was, for the most part, a rich and rewarding one, and we tried to honor that in the film. It was our intention to make a film about friendship that went terribly wrong." In order to bring a more humane version of the events to the screen, the filmmakers went on a nationwide search for people who were close or had some sort of involvement with Pauline Parker and Juliet Hume personally. In doing so, they managed to interview 17 former classmates and teachers from Christ Church Girls High School, as well as family, friends, neighbors, policemen, lawyers, and psychologists who had all known or interacted with the girls in some capacity. Also, in preparation for the film, Jackson and Walsh read Pauline's diary in order to gain a better understanding of who these girls really were. All of the journal voiceovers in the film were taken directly from real diary entries made by Pauline Parker, and even the fictional characters and worlds created by the two girls are portrayed authentically, with the visual effects for the film being done by Weta Digital, which would go on to make the Lord of the Rings films with Peter Jackson several years later. Jackson also insisted that almost all locations used for filming were the actual locations where the events took place.
Oh, that's interesting.
He actually had a short story where he described when they went to the place where the murder actually happened. And they were going to film there originally, but Jackson said that the bird stopped chirping and there was just an eerie feeling in the air. So they just decided that it wasn't right. So they moved a few hundred yards down away from the actual murder spot for the shooting of that scene.
One thing that was mentioned in the book I read about this that I really appreciate is that Peter Jackson was very cognizant when he was making this film, and he was adamant. He wanted to, like you said, portray it in an authentic way while also not being exploitative of the girls or glamorizing crime in general.
When it came to casting, Kate Winslet was one of 175 girls who auditioned for the role of Juliet, and she impressed Jackson with the intensity she was able to bring to the part. Screenwriter Fran Walsh discovered Melanie Lynskey, who had only ever been in school plays at the time, just 2 weeks before filming began, while searching local high schools for girls who physically resembled Parker. After she had been cast, Walsh showed Melanie a recording of Kate Winslet's audition tape and simply said, "This is how good you have to be." No pressure there whatsoever.
No, not at all.
During filming, Melanie and Kate were so into their roles that they would typically stay in character even when the cameras weren't rolling.
Ooh, method acting.
Yes, apparently they were very into the roles, and Jackson actually stated that they stayed in character after filming had wrapped for some time, and apparently the two women are still close friends to this day. And with that, here's the story of Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures. Our story begins with an old-time travel ad for Christ Church, New Zealand. There are beautiful streams and parks with various men sailing large toy boats. It is promoted as a peaceful city with flat roads and many bicyclists. We continue our tour through the town's sightsees, including an all-girls school, cricket field, and beautiful gardens. As the ad comes to a close, we start to hear the sounds of panicked screaming growing louder and louder until we cut to a POV shot of someone running through the woods screaming bloody murder. The screams are revealed to be that of Pauline Parker, played by Melanie Lynskey, and Juliet Hume, played by Kate Winslet, running as fast as they can, covered in blood and mud. There is also flashbacks of the two girls running and playing on a ship, calling playfully to their mummy and daddy, juxtaposing their carefree pasts with their nightmarish present. The two girls, still screaming hysterically, finally exit the woods and arrive at a nearby house and are spotted by one of its occupants, who cautiously exits to see what all the commotion is about. It is then that we finally get a good look at the two girls, completely drenched in blood, as they shout out, "It's Mummy. She's terribly hurt. Please help us," before cutting to black. The screen then reads, "During 1953 and 1954, Pauline Yvonne Parker kept diaries recording her friendship with Juliet Marion Hume. This is their story. All diary entries are in Pauline's own words." And the title Heavenly Creatures is then revealed. Cut to Christ Church Girls High School in 1952, where a choir is singing lovely songs about Christ. It is here that we meet Pauline, sitting in the middle of the choir, not singing a word.
I have a photo, a school photo, of Pauline. I think now would be kind of a good time.
Oh, yes.
For you to describe what you see. She is the only one not looking at the camera.
This is exactly how I would picture her. Linsky did this sort of posture the entire film. Her head was down the entire time. Very introverted looking. And I wouldn't say that they look identical, even though the film crew said that they were searching for actresses who had a similar appearance. But I think Linsky definitely was able to capture the physicality of her. She is sitting in this group in this photo. Everyone is smiling. Everyone looks like they're having a great day. But there's Pauline, head down, looking like she would rather be anywhere else in the world right now. Which is exactly how we are introduced to her in this scene of the film. Later on, in French class, the teacher is interrupted by the introduction of a new student, Juliette, who says she's from England and her father is the director of Canterbury College. Pauline sits in the back, doodling pictures of ponies, not really paying any attention. The teacher resumes her lesson, but is soon interrupted by Juliette, who corrects the teacher on a grammatical mistake she's made, patronizing and embarrassing the teacher in the process. This is what finally gets Pauline's attention. Next up is art class, where the two girls are assigned as partners for a figure drawing lesson. It's Juliette's turn to sketch Pauline first, who sits in a chair, slumped down, with her arms crossed, very much like the photo you just showed me, looking like she'd rather be anywhere else in the world right now. But when the picture is revealed to actually be of a knight who resembles famed musician Mario Lanza fighting a fire-breathing dragon with Pauline nowhere to be seen, it causes a faint smile to flash briefly across Pauline's face. The teacher lectures Juliette on not following the assignment and instructs her to do the drawing over again. But once the teacher leaves, Pauline confesses to Juliette that she thinks the drawing is fantastic.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yes, their relationship is portrayed very sweet. They are not portrayed as monsters in this film. And I think that's very important to note. This is a story about friendship. It is not the story of two murderers. The friendship is front and center the entire time. And it's done very, very sweetly, I must say.
Yeah, I'll get into that when I talk about the true story behind the movie, but it does seem that they were not quote unquote evil, but they had shared negative childhood experiences that drew them together and also pushed them further and further away from reality and more desperate than ever to maintain a connection with the one other person in the world that they really felt understood and cared for by.
Which is actually why Jackson and the co-screenwriter decided to not base the screenplay on newspaper articles and rather interviews and conversations that they had with real people who knew the real girls.
Yeah, that makes sense because it is a horrific crime. But everyone has a story to tell. So I think it is important to focus on the humanity of people to really understand why something happened.
I totally agree. And I would say this is in quite the contrast to the last film we had done, where the humanity is more cartoonish.
Yeah.
Back home from school, we meet Pauline's parents, Honora Parker Reaper, played by Sarah Pierce, and Herbert Reaper, played by Simon O'Connor, along with a tenant of theirs named Steve. Pauline quickly informs her parents that she got an A on an exam that day before running to the record player to put on a Mario Lanza album. As Pauline sits there enjoying her music immensely. I mean, she is loving listening to this music. I can't describe enough how much she is enjoying listening to Mario Lanza. But her father begins mocking the song by pretending that they are being sung by a floppy fish the family will be having for dinner later on that evening. Annoyed, Pauline pushes her father out of the room and goes back to her music.
So, I mean, if you think about it, that seems like a very minor thing that would happen in someone's day-to-day life. But to someone who already feels alienated by her family and like no one understands her, having someone mock what you are clearly very interested in would be disturbing.
I completely agree, especially for a teenager. Yeah. Teenagers, they take that sort of thing very personally.
Well, and these girls are like 14. They're like barely teenagers. So they're still in the throes of puberty and trying to find themselves and establish a place in their worlds.
Yes, I believe the film lists them as both being 15 years old. Sometime later, during gym class, all the girls lay on the ground doing various leg lifts. All the girls except Pauline and Juliet, who sit off to the side, not participating. Out of nowhere, Juliet asks if she can touch the scar on Pauline's leg, which is running down her shin. Pauline reluctantly agrees. The scar seems to excite Juliet, who goes on to brag she has scars of her own, only they're inside of her lungs due to respiratory illness as a child. Juliet goes on to say that she didn't see her parents for 5 years while she was treated for her condition. Pauline empathizes with Juliet, confessing that she also spent almost 2 years in the hospital getting her leg treated for osteomyelitis, and I apologize if I said that wrong, which causes Juliet to exclaim, "All the best people have bad chests and bone diseases. It's all frightfully romantic." On her way home from school, Pauline notices Juliet's house, and Juliet, dressed as a princess, playfully chasing her little brother, who is dressed as a knight. Pauline, who happens to have the Mario Lanza record with her, grabs her record and joins in on the chase. The three run through the woods before Juliet's brother starts playing a bit too rough with Pauline and causes her to accidentally break her Mario Lanza record.
So I also have photos of Juliet's home compared to Pauline's.
Oh,
so
okay.
As a side note, Juliet, because her father was a prominent person in the community with his position as basically the director of the local university, they were afforded living quarters that were spectacular, whereas Pauline, her parents were much poorer off and had jobs as like a secretary and a fishmonger. So she was immediately just fascinated with Juliet's lifestyle. So here's their homes. The top is Juliet's and the bottoms is Pauline's.
Again, I don't know if they used the actual locations, but it does look a lot like the house in the film. And they didn't really show the exterior of Pauline's home, but the difference between the two is pretty staggering. Juliet's house looks gorgeous. It has lush bushes with flowers and a chimney and giant windows and a back deck. It's gorgeous. And Pauline's home looks almost condemned. It looks like it's falling apart. It's bigger than I would have thought, but yeah, it is a basic, like a lower income family,
yeah,
New Zealand home. It is quite the difference between the two. The three run through the woods before Juliet's brother starts playing a bit too rough with Pauline and causes her to accidentally break her Mario Lanza record. Now angry and annoyed with her little brother, Juliet tells him to get lost or she'll go back to his bedroom and break every single one of his toys.
Aww.
I mean, he was being kind of a brat, so.
But every single toy.
That is a bit excessive, but she was being protective of her friend. She wanted to stand up for her. The two girls are then left alone to briefly mourn the passing of Pauline's Mario Lanza record. Back at Juliet's home, we meet her parents, Hilda Hume, played by Diana Kent, and Dr. Henry Hume, played by Clive Merrison. Juliet comes bursting in with Pauline and insists that they play a Mario Lanza record, much to her parents' dismay. And they proceed to joyously dance around the house in a fit of giddy laughter as they listen to a Mario Lanza record. These girls love Mario Lanza, who I had never heard of before this movie, in all honesty.
I mean, since I was also once a 15-year-old girl, I can really relate to just this obsession with someone who's a celebrity that you just adore and think is the perfect human.
As time passes, the two grow close, skipping gym class regularly, reading stories together, and playing around outside. One day, while out riding their bikes, Pauline narrowly avoids being hit by an oncoming vehicle, causing her bike to veer violently off the road and crash into a pile of bushes down the hill. Pauline pretends to be seriously hurt for a moment, and Juliet looks genuinely concerned until Pauline reveals it was all just a trick and the two go back to gleefully playing. While the two girls continue to play, they begin prancing around each other, singing songs, and start ripping their clothes off, until finally falling into each other's arms and kissing for the very first time. I know there is some controversy around this aspect of the film, as one of the girls has said that there was no romantic relationship between the two of them.
So yes, adults in their lives that witnessed how close these girls became suspected there was a homosexual attraction, but both of the girls throughout the progression of their trial, they were obviously evaluated by several psychologists or psychiatrists, and they adamantly denied that there was a sexual relationship. In fact, one of them, I think it was Pauline, even said, "We are both women. How would that even work?" So adults in their life suspected it, but both girls adamantly denied it, even to this day.
Interesting. Then there's a part of this story coming up that I am anxious to find out if it actually occurred, because that aspect does play into it pretty heavily. One night, while the two girls stay up late cutting out pictures of celebrities from magazines, Pauline brings up the possibility of one of their favorite actors potentially starring in a biblical picture. Juliet reveals that she doesn't believe in the Bible and that she's going to a place called the Fourth World after she dies, which she describes as like heaven, only better because it doesn't have any Christians. It is a place filled with music, art, and pure enjoyment.
I mean, take me now.
We go there several times throughout the course of the film, and the Fourth World is an interesting place, to say the least. And side note here, Juliet really hates Orson Welles for some reason, and calls him a hideous man when Pauline brings him up. This actually does come into play later. It's very random. From here, we come to Christmas! Pauline and her family are all gathered around the tree Christmas morning, opening their presents. This is where Pauline gets her diary, which the film is supposedly based on. Sometime later, Juliet comes over to Pauline's house for dinner and to meet Pauline's parents for the first time. During dinner, Juliet dominates the conversations with talk of knights and dragons before being asked about her parents. She says her mother is a couples counselor who convinces couples not to get divorced, but it is implied that her mother may use her own sexual means in order to do so. Pauline's father is revealed to be the manager of a fish supply store. The two girls also reveal that they plan to write a novel together. Port Levy, Easter, 1953. Pauline joins Juliet and her family on a trip to their family's home in the country. They all have a wonderful time together, and Juliet's mother even calls Pauline her foster daughter, till Juliet's parents reveal that they plan on leaving the country for several months on business and leaving Juliet behind so that she can continue to attend school. This devastates Juliet, who runs off crying until she's found by Pauline, who tries to comfort her. Juliet manages to compose herself by escaping into the Fourth World, and the two begin fantasizing about giant butterflies and beautiful, lush scenery in order to escape Juliet's feelings of abandonment. After the experience, the two girls decide that they must have an extra part of their brains that allows them to access the Fourth World. When they die, they will go to the Fourth World, but until then, they can enter the Fourth World for 2 days every year on Easter weekend. Hmm. I don't know how they decided upon these exact rules, but I guess you need some groundwork. Later on, in class, Juliet does a presentation in front of her class describing the novel that her and Pauline are writing, which involves depictions of various sexual encounters. The teacher, clearly upset, tries repeatedly to stop Juliet from continuing with her story until Pauline finally stands up for Juliet. After returning to her seat, Juliet begins to cough uncontrollably and soon starts coughing blood. It is soon revealed that Juliet has tuberculosis on one lung. Despite this tragic news, her parents decide to continue on with their plans to leave the country and will leave Juliet in the hospital alone for 4 months while Juliet tries to recuperate.
So, side note, at this time, there was a cure for tuberculosis, but it was still a very long and painful recovery.
As we will go into in just a moment as well. This is not the end for Juliet. She will continue on, despite the TB. Meanwhile, Pauline is also not allowed to visit Juliet during her stay in the hospital due to risk of infection. Both girls are devastated. Eventually, Pauline gets the idea to write letters to Juliet in the hospital as if they were written by the fictional characters from the girl's novel. Juliet receives the letters and does the same in response, with the letters acting as another way for the two girls to escape back into the fantasy world that they have both created together, using their real-life experiences as metaphors within the stories.
I mean, this makes sense, right? She's stuck in a hospital with a terrible illness for months. Her family is like, well, I mean, we have a vacation planned, so hope you're fine. So her only outlet is the one person and the world that they have developed together.
And I must say, I can completely understand this. I was in a boarding school when I was a teenager, and there was a lot of times where I was writing my own little stories, I was writing my own screenplays, I was writing just as an escape to create my own world with different characters and situations, basically to not focus on my current situation. The girls' stories soon take on a much darker tone when they start to become increasingly more violent, often fantasizing about slaughtering those around them in horrific detail. Finally, after several months, the two girls are reunited at the hospital once Juliet is no longer deemed contagious. Needless to say, the two girls are ecstatic to see one another. During the visit, Pauline's mother notices that Juliet hasn't opened any of the letters her parents have sent to her during her time in the hospital. When asked about this, Juliet snaps at Honora, who also went by Nora, about her parents leaving her yet again. After this, Nora decides that it is time to leave, and the two girls are forced to part ways yet again. During their next visit, Pauline reveals to Juliet that she thinks John, the Parker family's new roommate, has a crush on her, which seems to displease Juliet. Pauline quickly backpedals and says that she was only teasing. However, one night, John comes to Pauline's room, claiming that he can't sleep and tries to get into bed with her in order to warm up, which Pauline agrees to. That night, John tries to have sex with Pauline, but is caught by Pauline's father, who blames Pauline for the infraction.
Side note, this gentleman, John Bolton, was a college student at the local university. So he had to be at least 18. So statutory rape.
And I know the family had an extra room that they would regularly rent out. And I believe John was one of the many occupants of this room.
Yes, he was.
The next morning, John is gone, having been kicked out by Pauline's parents. Pauline is then berated by her mother all morning. And when Pauline tries to talk back, her mother slaps her. That night, Pauline runs away from home to see John, and the two have sex together, while Pauline fantasizes about being back in the fourth world with Juliet. Sometime later, the day has finally come for Juliet to leave the hospital, and Pauline is there to see her out with Juliet's father. On the drive home, Juliet's father notices Pauline and Juliet holding hands in the back seat. From that time forward, the two girls become inseparable and start escaping to the fourth world on a more regular basis, while Juliet's father continues to grow more and more suspicious of the girls' extremely close relationship. One night, Juliet's father decides to come over to Pauline's parents' house to discuss the matter personally. Both parents agree that the two girls' relationship is unhealthy, and Juliet's father confesses his suspicions about the two girls' intimacy, and recommends a doctor for Pauline to see regarding the matter, which her parents both agree to. At the doctor, Pauline is advised against becoming so close with another girl, and recommends that she start spending more time with boys. During this conversation, Pauline fantasizes about the doctor being murdered. After the session, the doctor meets with Pauline's parents and says that she's a homosexual, which horrifies Pauline's mother, but the doctor reassures her that she should grow out of it.
Which, by the time at this point in our history, homosexuality was a diagnosable psychiatric condition. I don't think it was removed from the Diagnostical Statistical Manual, which is the DSM, basically the guidebook for psychology and psychiatry that lists all mental health disorders. I don't think it was removed until like the 70s.
Homosexuality was actually listed as a psychological condition?
Yeah, it wasn't removed until like the 4th update of the manual.
That is horrendous. After the visit, Pauline's parents tell Pauline that she needs to spend less time with Juliet, which causes her to go into a deep depression. As time passes, Pauline's grades begin to fall, which causes even more conflict between Pauline and her mother, and Pauline is soon forced to drop out of school and get a job as a typist. As time continues to pass, Pauline grows more and more depressed until one night during a sleepover, Juliet tells Pauline that they should run away together. Early that morning, the two girls steal a bunch of their parents' valuables in order to sell to fund a trip when the time comes. It is also revealed that Juliet's parents are having their own issues, with Juliet's father losing his job and her mother having an affair. Pauline and her mother continue arguing on a regular basis, and Pauline soon starts blaming her mother for standing in the way of her and Juliet, and even fantasizes about killing both of her parents in horribly graphic ways. April 23rd, 1954. Late one night, Juliet catches her mother in bed with another man and finds out that Juliet's mother and father are getting a divorce. Juliet freaks out upon hearing this, and Pauline quickly comes over to the house to comfort Juliet. After Pauline leaves, Juliet's father explains that he'll be moving back to England, and her parents think it would be best if Juliet went to live with a relative somewhere in South Africa. This news does not sit well with Juliet or Pauline. The two girls then attempt to buy tickets to America to escape being separated, but are unsuccessful when Pauline is denied a passport until her 20th birthday without her parents' consent. Tensions continue to grow in the two households until Pauline finally makes the decision to kill her mother. Out of concern for the girls' erratic behavior, the girls' parents eventually have a meeting and decide it might be easier on the girls if they were allowed to spend their remaining weeks together before Juliet leaves for South Africa. June 11th, 1954. Pauline and Juliet are once again allowed to reunite and escape into their fantasy world together. Later on, the two girls see a movie and imagine being stalked by Orson Welles on their way home. I know, right?
Not what I imagine when I watch movies, but to each their own.
The terrifying Orson Welles.
Yeah, no, thank you.
That night, the two girls make love for the first time, and Pauline confesses her plan to kill her mother, which Juliet seemingly agrees to. June 21st, 1954. Once back at her home, Pauline acts as if everything is normal, but secretly plans to bash her mother's head in with a large rock the following day. The next day, Juliet grabs a brick from the backyard of her parents' home and hides it in her handbag before being dropped off to see Pauline. Once at Pauline's home, the two girls go upstairs so Pauline can put the brick inside of a pair of stockings. Juliet seems nervous while Pauline continues to discuss their fantasy world. Once finished, Pauline puts the brick back in Juliet's handbag and they both head downstairs for lunch. After the family eats, Pauline's father excuses himself and heads out, while Pauline's mother takes the two girls out to get some tea somewhere in the countryside. After tea, the three go for a walk in the woods together, Once deep in the woods, Juliet pretends to drop some jewelry on the ground, and when Pauline's mother bends over to pick it up, Pauline removes the brick from the handbag and bashes her mother in the head. The two girls continue by taking turns beating Pauline's mother while she begs for mercy. We end on a shot of Pauline covered in blood, screaming, before cutting to black, and we are given the following information. In the hours following Nora's murder, a police search of the Reaper house unearthed Pauline's diaries. This resulted in her immediate arrest for the murder of her mother. Juliet was arrested and charged with murder the following day. After Pauline's arrest, it was discovered that Nora and Herbert Reaper had never married. Pauline was therefore charged under her mother's maiden name of Parker. In August 1954, a plea of insanity was rejected by the jury in the Christchurch Supreme Court trial, and Pauline Parker and Juliet Hume were found guilty of murder. Too young for the death penalty, they were sent to separate prisons to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure. Juliet was released in November 1959 and immediately left New Zealand to join her mother overseas. Pauline was released 2 weeks later, but remained in New Zealand on parole until 1965. It was a condition of their release that they never meet again. And that is Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures. What do you think, Ashley?
So, I think that if someone, a director, wants to do a true crime story adaptation and wants to stick to the source material accurately, this is a great movie to base that off of.
I agree. I admire the attention to detail. I admire Peter Jackson's method of talking to people who actually knew the girls. I believe it created a much more intimate portrayal of the two girls instead of something that was only seen through the media. And I think he did his homework. I think they all did their homework. And this is not Peter Jackson's first film, but it was Kate Winslet and Melanie Lynskey's first film. And they brought it, man. They came out swinging. It's a crazy introduction to some of the biggest names in Hollywood. It's a very interesting film to start all of their careers.
Yeah, I'm very excited to watch it again in the future once we have a few more episodes made so it's not as, you know, fresh in your mind.
I am down. A lot of the times when I watch these films for this podcast, it is not for enjoyment. It is to meticulously take notes and pick apart. So I would be glad to rewatch this someday under the pretense of, I don't know if enjoying is the right word, but it's rewatching this film. A little bit of history after the film was released. Upon its release, the film received a restricted rating in most countries, except in New Zealand, where it received a PG rating.
What?
Exactly. It is the only country where it got a PG rating. But very interesting. I think they just wanted to encourage everyone to see. This was a very big movie in New Zealand, so I think they were really trying to encourage everybody to go out and see this film. And they were right to do so. Heavenly Creatures garnered near universal praise by critics and currently has a 93% rating on Rotten Tomatoes with a critical consensus of dark, stylish, and captivating. Heavenly Creatures signals both the auspicious debut of Kate Winslet and the arrival of Peter Jackson as more than just a cult director. The film also holds a score of 86 out of 100 on Metacritic. The film was also included in several top 10 lists that year, including Time Magazine, The Guardian, The Sydney Morning Herald, and The New Zealand Herald, and it also appears in the book 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die.
Oh, wow.
Heavenly Creatures was also nominated for several awards that year, including an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay, and a win for Kate Winslet at the first ever Empire Awards for Best British Actress.
I agree.
Pretty good start to your career, Kate. In the film's home country of New Zealand, the film won 9 out of 10 nominations at the New Zealand Film and TV Awards, but was not nominated for Best Picture for some reason. And now, just a few fun facts. Kate Winslet's sister, Anna Winslet, appeared in the Cater Street Hangman in 1998, which was written by Anne Perry, who, can you fill this one in for me, Ashley?
Juliet Hume changed her name.
Yes, Juliet Hume changed her name to Anne Perry and became a writer and actually wrote one of the films that Kate Winslet's sister appeared in.
That is nuts. Not only did she become a writer, she became a writer. She made millions of dollars off of her writing career.
From what I gathered, she definitely went on to flourish more than Pauline, who, from everything that I could tell, just sort of vanished into obscurity after this. Another fun fact, The Simpsons released an episode entitled Lisa the Drama Queen in season 20, which was loosely based on the film and co-starred Emily Blunt as Juliet. I have not seen the episode, but I find it very interesting that The Simpsons would make an episode based on this random 1994 New Zealand film, which I feel very few people have actually seen.
So Remy, what are your final reviews or thoughts about the movie?
I will go back to what I was saying earlier. I don't know if enjoyed would be the right word to describe my experience watching this film, but I definitely liked it. Jackson is a Monty Python fan, and the film looks like a Monty Python film, as strange as that sounds. The entire thing has a sort of hyper-reality feel to it, which I guess goes well with the various fantasy elements Jackson was trying to incorporate. This definitely gives the film a unique look, and I must say that Jackson really does direct the shit out of this movie, and you can tell it was a story he was really passionate about. I don't know if I would have chosen to shoot the story in this specific style, but I do think it works for this film, and Jackson did a great job pulling it off. The performances are all very over the top, and even though Winslet's performance was universally praised and she was nominated for and won several awards, I gotta say it was my least favorite performance in the entire film. She's a bit much, and even though she was very young when she made this film, I never truly bought her as a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
Melanie Lynskey, on the other hand, I thought did a fabulous job for a first-timer, and her performance felt much more natural than Winslet's. I'm not saying that Winslet's performance is bad by any means. It is just very exaggerated, and I believe that was a directing choice and not an acting choice. It's also the only time I think I've ever heard Melanie Lynskey speak in her native New Zealand accent. Yes, Melanie Lynskey is from New Zealand. She was found in a New Zealand high school performing high school plays when she got this role.
Wow. So if it wasn't for this movie being like randomly filmed in New Zealand by a prominent director, who knows if or when we would have been lucky enough to know this actress.
I watched several interviews with Melanie Lynskey in preparation for this, and she does associate this film with what got her started. She said after this film came out, she got an agent, she got a manager. Huh. It basically launched her entire career, and Kate Winslet had only been in, I think, like, TV movies at the time. This was her first film, and she went on to huge things in the acting world. And even, again, Peter Jackson made some of the biggest movies of all time. This was a starting point for so many careers, and I found it a very interesting starting point. It's not one that you would think of when thinking of these people's start to their careers. Overall, I found this film very creative, yet accurate in their portrayal of the events. And that is an interesting combination, because usually accuracy is not what I would say as closely associated with creativity.
See our next episode coming out next week about Scream.
Yes, that is a whole other barrel of Scream masks right there. In the end, I would say that I would recommend this movie, and from what I gathered about the true story, I think it was an accurate portrayal, and everyone who was involved gave it their all, and it truly does show. And even the country of New Zealand seems to prop this film up as something to be proud of, and I think it is a very good film. Again, not enjoyable, but it is a good film.
Well, Remy, are you ready to hear the true story behind Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures?
Oh, am I?
All right, so before we begin, a little shout out to my primary source material. I read a book that was authored by Peter Graham in 2011 called Anne Perry and the Murder of the Century. Juliet Hulme was born in London in October 1938. World War II was declared less than 1 year later. By 1941, London had been bombed 71 times, and these were major bombings. They were so severe that the Humes had a bomb shelter built on their property. Juliet also suffered frequent night terrors. During the war, her father was a mathematical physicist who worked with the government to develop a device to protect ships from magnets. The war conditions resulted in Juliet often being separated from her family. Little was known about childhood attachment theory at that time. Essentially, very, very, very briefly, what we have learned is that separating young children from their parents during the ages from birth to like 5 has a significant impact on their psychological development. When Juliet was home, she was demanding and overly sensitive, which irritated her mother. Juliet's brother, Jonathan, was born when she was 5 years old. She was deeply distressed when she woke up the next morning and learned that both her mother and brother were ill and she could not visit them. Soon after, she was sent away to live in London, followed by Barbados, reportedly because her mother's poor health and because Juliet contracted pneumonia and bronchitis, and doctors thought she would fare better in a warmer climate. She did not live with anyone she knew when she was in Barbados. She did end up living with distant relatives or family friends when she moved to the Bahamas at some point when she was about 8 years old. Her father accepted a job as the head of a university in New Zealand in 1947. Juliet was then reunited with her family in Christchurch, New Zealand, 10 months later, so around October 1948. Mr. Hulme became a prominent figure in the community, while rumors about Miss Hulme's infidelity circled the town. Both were described as having an aloof and cold parenting style. Juliet started Christchurch High School in 1952. A few years before, she was given an IQ test and she scored 170, which is incredibly high. That's like genius level. Average IQ is about 100.
So she was brilliant.
She was a very smart girl.
Okay, I think that is another bit of contrast between her and Pauline, because Pauline was depicted as someone who struggled with her schoolings and that sort of thing.
After she started high school, several classmates were really intrigued by Juliet and they really wanted to be her friend. She was basically viewed as this proper high-class London girl. But Juliet was dismissive and seemed completely uninterested in getting to know anyone. That is, until she met Pauline Parker. As the year progressed, they became friendly, which really surprised everyone because Pauline was a bit of a misfit. She always seemed angry. She liked to be called Paul. She walked with a slight limp. And she came from much more modest means. Pauline's parents, Bert and Nora, met in 1931. Although they lived together as a married couple for 25 years, they never legally married. And this was because Bert met Nora while he was married to another woman. He then left his wife and his two sons to be with Nora. By 1934, they bought a house and quickly had three children. The first child only lived a day. Their second child, Wendy, was born in 1937, and Pauline followed 1 year later. When Pauline was five, she developed a bone marrow infection in her leg. She spent 8 or 9 months in a hospital undergoing painful medical treatments. It would be another 2 years before she did not scream in agony when the dressing on her leg was changed. Although she was mostly recovered about a year later, she walked with a limp and continued to have chronic pain.
Terrible. Sounds terrible.
Pauline was the only child in her class for the 2 years after she returned to school when she was 9 years old. That's how small this town was. Her personality had changed to the point where she was always moody and frequently had temper tantrums. By this time in her life, her father worked at a fish and chip shop, and her mother was a secretary. The family lived in a small, untidy home that frequently smelled like fish. A third daughter was born in 1949. Nora was 42 years old at the time, and the baby was born with Down syndrome. Nora quit her job to care for her new baby, Rosemary. It's not clear when, but at some point when Rosemary was young, she was sent to live at a residential home for intellectually disabled children. Although many parents in New Zealand essentially dropped their kids off and never returned or had any future contact with their disabled kids, Pauline's family visited Rosemary every weekend. They often brought her home for weekend visits and holiday celebrations. Pauline was described as always being kind to her younger sister. As she aged, Pauline continued to be a challenge for her parents. Her mother was thought to be well-intentioned, but she often tried to control Pauline and frequently lost her temper. The author of this book makes it clear that it is not known whether Pauline's mother was abusive, but she did yell a lot, and so it wouldn't have been surprising if she did slap her daughter at some point.
In the film, she only physically hits her daughter one time. The rest of it is all just verbal assaults.
Yeah, and I think how they described it in the book was like she would lose her temper because Pauline was just a very moody child and just very difficult to parent. And her mother, to try to help Pauline, would try to just be overly controlling of her, which caused Pauline to become upset more and more frequently. Juliet and Pauline were both late 14 years old when they met at Christchurch Girls High School. They quickly developed a friendship. This likely happened because they were the only two students in their class who were not allowed to go to PE or play outside because of their health conditions.
Oh, okay. It never was very clear about that in the film. I had just assumed that they were not choosing to participate in PE, but it was actually a medical condition that prohibited them from participating.
Yeah, Pauline for her leg condition, and Juliet had chronic lung problems because of the pneumonia and bronchitis she contracted when she was young. While all their other classmates were outside having fun, Pauline and Juliet spent long periods of time together inside. Both girls were very interested in poetry and just the fantasy genre in general. Pauline became fascinated by Juliet's upper-class family and the beautiful home, both of which were so different from her own. They were inseparable within a few months after they met. During the first year of their friendship, they primarily did everyday things that you would expect 14-year-old girls to do. They rode Juliet's horses, they played dress-up, they wrote poetry together, and they acted out plays, always with Juliet as the star.
You and I do not perform enough poetry and plays together, Ashley. We need to incorporate that more into our relationship, I think.
I think we can incorporate that into weekly date nights.
It's the foundations for a beautiful relationship.
By the end of 1952, Pauline's parents started taking in boarders, most of which were university students or student teachers. By the end of the school year, the girls started sneaking out at night. But most of the time, they just went to the park or the beach or rode Juliet's horses. Throughout 1953, the girls wrote a lot of poetry and fantasy stories. Pauline and Juliet also kept diaries and wrote about how the girls were geniuses and destined for fame. In May 1953, Juliet was admitted to a hospital for tuberculosis. Her parents had a 3-month trip to the United States planned, which they did not reschedule after Juliet was hospitalized. So Juliet was alone for much of her recovery. In the hospital, she was allowed visitors once a week. Those visitors often included a close family friend of the Humes. Pauline and her mother also visited once a month. She was discharged from the hospital in August of 1953. While Juliet was in the hospital, Pauline's stories shifted and contained much darker themes. We're talking rape, murder, suicide, and torture. She also started a sexual relationship with one of the boarders, which was off and on for many months. Per the book, they attempted sexual intercourse several times, but because he was a man and she was a 15-year-old girl at this time, it made it difficult. But it does seem to be believed that they did have sex once during this time. After Juliet was released from the hospital, the only thing she seemed to care about was her friendship with Pauline, and likewise. By October, the girls decided to change their names to Deborah, which was Juliet's name, and Gina, which was Pauline's name. These names were taken from fantasy films that they both enjoyed. In November, Pauline's parents sought psychiatric care for Pauline at the suggestion of the Humes. This was done for two reasons. One, the parents were concerned that they were developing a sexual relationship. And two, Pauline had developed a severe eating disorder. It was so bad that she actually stopped having her period. Pauline didn't speak much to the psychiatrist during the one initial visit, but she did say that her friendship with Juliet was the only thing that mattered to her. The doctor told her parents that there was a, quote, homosexual attachment between the two girls, but he thought that it would eventually fizzle out as they aged. By December of that year, Juliet's mother started having an affair with Bill Perry, who, side note, was one of the last soldiers to leave Dunkirk. Interestingly, Juliet's mom actually moved Bill into the family home. So he lived in the same home with Juliet, her brother, and her parents. It seemed that they tried to hide their sexual relationship for a while, but by the time the murder happened, her father was well aware of what was going on. Juliet and Pauline were separated during the 1953/1954 winter holidays, but they still spoke on the phone daily and wrote letters to each other constantly. Pauline spent her time with her boyfriend, playing with her younger sister, and going to church. She actually seemed in really good spirits during this time, which was encouraging to her parents and kind of fueled their belief that Juliet was the problem. She even secretly bought a horse, which after her parents found out about, were ecstatic because they thought, well, maybe our daughter will spend more time with the horse and less time with Juliet. During the first 2 months that Pauline had this horse, she rode her bike for miles every day to visit and ride it. Juliet and her family returned from holiday in February 1954. The girls started fantasizing about moving to Hollywood to turn their books into movies. Pauline's relationship with her mother worsened, and she started thinking about what her life would be if her mother was not alive. The girls also started worshiping what they called the quote-unquote saints. The saints were a list of attractive celebrities and fictional characters that they adored. Their main quote-unquote saint was an actor named James Mason. Have you heard of James Mason?
I have heard of James Mason, but I find it quite shocking and a tad appalling that Mario Lanza is not the first name out of your lips when referring to who these girls admired and loved.
So Mario Lanza, I don't know where I'm going to be able to find it in the book, but he might have been there. They essentially, the saints had, there was a long, long list, and there were two or three of them that were the quote-unquote top gods, and James Mason was the numero uno. The girls loved this guy so much that they made a shrine to him in Juliet's backyard.
This was touched upon in the movie as well. I failed to mention it, but this was touched upon.
Yeah, they spoke about how they would go out there all the time and sometimes even slept out there in front of this shrine. By March of 1954, Pauline decided that she was going to sell her horse. Remember, this is the horse that she loved. She rode her bike miles every single day to ride and care for and groom the horse. By then, the girls were virtually inseparable. They essentially slept together in Juliet's bed most nights, and they fantasized about what their life in Hollywood would be like. They took pictures of each other modeling, sometimes nude, and practiced singing. By April of 1954, Mr. Hume was forced to resign. There had been a lot of backlash at the university about how he essentially handled things, so he was pushed out. He made a plan to go to England to search for employment. Juliet would go with him, but she would be staying in South Africa with an aunt during the winter while she was still recovering from tuberculosis. Once the winter was over, she was going to join her father in England, and her mother and her brother would also be joining when the school year ended. Juliet was very upset about leaving Pauline and desperately wanted her to come along, but everyone knew Pauline's mother wouldn't allow it. In the book, this is what's really sad, it sounded like Juliet's parents kind of entertained the idea that it would be a possibility for Pauline to come, while deep down knowing it was never going to happen and having no intention of even asking Pauline's parents. On April 28th, Pauline wrote in her diary about concocting a plan to kill her mother in a way that would appear, quote, either a natural or accidental death.
I don't think that's the plan that they went with.
They tried, but they failed. In June, the girls finalized a plan which they thought would increase their chances of Pauline being able to go with Juliet to South Africa. They decided they would go on a walk with Pauline's mother, bash her in the head with a brick, and then claim she fell. They knew there was a possibility that they could be prosecuted for the crime, but they had two thoughts. One, they thought their punishment would be light because they were minors. And two, if convicted, they would surely be incarcerated together. On the day before the murder, June 21st, 1954, Pauline wrote the following in her diary. I feel very keyed up, as though I were planning a surprise party. Mother has fallen in with everything beautifully, and the happy event is to take place tomorrow afternoon. So next time I write in this diary, Mother will be dead. How odd, yet how pleasing.
Haunting, haunting, haunting.
It really is. It really is. June 22nd, 1954. Mr. Hume dropped Juliet off in town in the morning on his way to work, and she walked to Pauline's house. Both girls had been in a cheerful mood for the past few days, which was unusual. Pauline had even offered to help her mother clean up around the house, which is something she hadn't done for years at this point. The family enjoyed a lovely lunch together, and the girls and Pauline's mother headed to a local park. They stopped to get some tea and went into the woods around 3. During the walk, Juliet walked ahead and dropped a pink stone. She then called for Nora and Pauline to look at it. As Nora bent down to take a look at the stone, Pauline started bashing her in the head with a brick. Juliet, at some point, also joined in, and one of the girls choked Nora until she was dead.
I will chime in here to say that I did read that the depiction of this in the film is a much more toned down version than the actual events. What actually occurred was far more gruesome than what was portrayed in the movie.
Yeah, it was brutal. The police announced a statement that Nora died immediately, but by the crime scene, it was clear that she fought like hell. Around 3:30, the girls ran up to the park caretakers. They were covered in blood, all over their hands, face, and clothes. They started screaming about how Nora slipped, hit her head on a rock, and might be dead. They said they tried to drag her out of the woods, but she was just too heavy, so they left her. One of the caretakers waited for the girls while an ambulance arrived, while the other one went to find Nora. While waiting for an ambulance, the girls washed the blood off their hands and reiterated the story about what happened to Nora. Once the caretaker who went to investigate found Nora, they quickly realized that the girls' stories was suspect, and they called the police. Mr. Hume, who was also phoned, arrived before the police. He left his phone number and address and took the girls home. The girls maintained their story that Nora fell, but Juliet's parents thought that was unlikely, given the amount of blood that was all over the girls.
If it was anything like the film, these girls were covered head to toe in blood.
That's what the book made it seem like as well. Juliet's parents told the girls to take a bath. Bill Perry, who was Miss Holmes' lover, dropped their jackets off at the local dry cleaner. The girls were both given dinner, a sedative, and put to sleep in Juliet's bed. Back at the park, it was immediately clear to law enforcement that Nora did not fall. There was blood everywhere. There was clear defense wounds on her hands, and there were strangulation marks on her throat. The two detectives went to the Humes that evening to interview the girls. Before they arrived, Miss Hume went into Juliet's room, gathered Juliet's diaries, letters to Pauline, and various other writings. Some of them were put in a box to give to police later, and others were destroyed. It is always referenced with this case that Pauline had a diary. Juliet also had a diary, and it was likely destroyed by her mother because of the incriminating writings in it. If it's anything like Pauline's diary, there was definitely concerning things in there that you would not want police to see.
Interesting. So there was two diaries.
Yeah. Both girls told a nearly identical story when they were separately interviewed by police. But Juliet, who was taken out of the room to talk to her parents in a private room, returned to her interrogation and changed her story. She denied seeing Pauline's mother fall. She said she heard a loud commotion, and when she got back to the scene, Nora was already on the ground. She said she originally lied to help Pauline out. Police then spoke to Pauline again and essentially told them what Juliet said. They also told her that they suspected that she killed her mother. Pauline went along with that story and admitted to assaulting her mother with a brick that she brought with her to the park. She likely did so because of how much she loved Juliet and her mother. She would not answer any questions about why she killed her mom, but she did sign a written confession that read as follows. I wish to state that Juliet did not know of my intentions and did not see me strike my mother. I took the chance to strike my mother when Juliet was away. She was then arrested and taken to the police station.
So it's almost like a final act of love, her trying to take the fall for Juliet.
Yeah, she desperately did not want to disappoint Juliet or Miss Hume because, like you had said when you were talking about the movie, Miss Hume often referred to Pauline as her foster daughter, and Pauline loved Juliet and her family, so she viewed it as a way that she could take the fall and protect them. At the police station, Pauline was taken to the detective's office. She immediately started writing her daily diary entry for that day on a piece of paper.
She is committed, I'll give her that.
On that piece of paper, she wrote that she had murdered her mom. The rest of the entry read as follows. All the Humes have been wonderfully kind and sympathetic. Anyone would think I'd been good. I've had a pleasant time with the police, talking to the dozen and behaving as though I hadn't a care in the world. I haven't had a chance to talk to Deborah, remember that's Juliet, properly, but I am taking the blame for everything. The detective, as soon as he came in and saw she was writing something, took the piece of paper, read it, and quickly realized that Juliet was involved after all.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. If you plan on committing any sort of illegal activity, please don't keep a journal.
And also, don't write in that journal entry while you're sitting in the police station confessing to your illegal activity.
I would say that's a fairly good tip, but I would assume that she must be compelled, almost like a compulsion, to make these entries. I mean, talk about the wrong place and the wrong time to start writing down your inner monologue. I mean, if she had any sort of self-awareness, she would know that would doom her, but it seems like she almost couldn't help herself. She needed to get that information out of her, and that's the way that she's been doing it for so long.
Yeah, I never kept a diary when I was younger, but I did know people who did, and it was a religious thing. You write in it every single day.
I kept a fake diary when I was younger that just had me going to school and doing my homework, and it was left out on several tables in order for people to take a peek and know that I was up to nothing wrong whatsoever.
After the detective took the piece of paper, he first went to Pauline's house and found her diary. The entry from the day prior made it clear that the murder was planned. The detectives went back to the Hume household the next day to speak to Juliet. During that conversation, she admitted that both girls planned the murder because they did not want to be separated. She also signed a written confession. The girls were lodged in the same cell together that night, as there was only one cell for females. They stayed, if not in the exact same cell, they stayed in very close proximity to each other until their trial, or even throughout the duration of the trial.
So they were in close proximity during the trial, then?
Yeah, because the jail was so small. And jails aren't like prisons. They don't have male jails and female jails. So they separate the two sexes, but they're still in the same facility. So because this jail was so small, there was no way to separate the two. Let's talk a little bit about the investigation. Mr. Hume left for England as planned, even after Juliet was arrested. Both families obtained separate legal counsel. After looking at the signed confessions, it became clear that the only possible defense would involve pleading insanity. If successful, both girls would be sentenced to an indefinite commitment at a psychiatric facility. To qualify for the insanity defense, the defense would have to argue that the girls were suffering from a disease of the mind to such an extent that they were incapable of understanding the nature and quality of the act or knowing that the act was wrong.
I feel like that would be difficult to prove, knowing that the crime was premeditated.
Yes, that is a big check mark in the not insane at the time column. However, each of the two legal teams hired their own psychiatric expert to evaluate the girls. Neither of the two had much, if any, experience at all testifying in court. Also, they worked closely together, which is so not okay, throughout the course of the evaluations. Both psychiatrists interviewed both girls and various family members, which is fine, but they also frequently shared their interview notes to compare with each other. During the evaluations, both girls were described as remorseless, cheerful, hostile, and abusive. Juliet at one point said she would murder anyone who tried to come between her and Pauline. while awaiting trial, the girls continued to write a lot of poetry, and they genuinely seemed very cheerful to be together. So, Remy, I have a photo to show you of Pauline and Juliet. This is the day they were indicted for murder.
Okay, I'm looking at them here. This is actually the first time I have seen the two of them together, the real-life people. And I do see similarities between them and the actresses. It's not a dead ringer situation, but they do look very similar. And even in this photo, you can tell that Juliet is a woman of means, and Pauline is someone who is struggling a bit more as far as finances go. She has a shawl over her head, a black worn coat, while Juliet has a very nice sports coat of some sort, a lovely dress. Her hair's done up nice.
She looks stunning.
She looks great. For someone going on trial for murder, she really, really has her look down.
And this is directly after they had both been charged with murder. And they have, obviously, Juliet is more animated in the face, but she has a very wide smile. And even Pauline, you can tell she's smiling.
Yes, they don't look worried. They don't look like the severity of the situation is playing a factor in their expression at all. They look like they're having a good day.
And they essentially maintained that positive affect even as their trial was going on. They were described as being cheerful and not really having much of a care in the world. Speaking of the trial, the 5-day trial started in August 1954. The courtroom was filled with well-dressed women and news reporters from around the world. Juliet's mother and her boyfriend, Bill Perry, attended every single day, even though they both repeatedly tried to visit Juliet in jail and subsequently prison, and Juliet refused to see them even once. Pauline's father, on the other hand, only went to the trial when he was called to testify. Both defense psychiatric experts opined that the girls met criteria for shared insanity, which is referred to as, I'm going to butcher this, foi à deux. If you're interested in seeing the upcoming Joker movie, that's the mental illness that will be depicted in that.
What is foi à deux? Could you describe it for us?
Yeah, so it's extremely rare. Essentially, it is believed to be a condition where there's more than one person involved. I think often it's two. And one person has a psychotic thought process going on, and the other person is roped into or also develops the same psychotic beliefs. So it is a shared psychosis. They both have the same psychotic symptoms and delusional beliefs happening at the same time because of their close connection with each other.
I don't know if this is still accurate to this day, but in an interview that I saw with Peter Jackson, he had mentioned that nobody has ever successfully argued this in court. This has been argued just a handful of times, and it has never worked for anyone.
Well, I think this is a good time to insert a myth about the insanity defense. Oftentimes when we hear about the insanity defense, it's with these big cases. It is a common misconception that the insanity defense is, first off, often attempted. Second, that it is often successful. That is not true. The insanity defense is used in It's less than 1-2% of criminal cases. And of that 1-2%, it is successful 25% of the time. Another misconception is that it is essentially a quote unquote get out of jail free card. People plead insanity and then they're just let out to wander the streets. In reality, people that are found not guilty by reason of insanity end up spending much more time in institutions or under some sort of supervision for longer than if they would have been given the maximum sentence for the crime they committed.
Yes, and I think that Hollywood has actually perpetuated the stereotype of the insanity plea being a regular occurrence when it actually is something that is far more rare. And just like you said, it's even more rare that it is successful. But if you were to go by what you see in TV and movies, every other case has an insanity plea going on.
The big case that sparked public rage about this was John Hinckley and the assassination attempt of Reagan.
Interesting. So Hinckley pled insanity.
He did, and he was successful in his plea. Because of that, people became outraged, and there was a overhaul across the United States of the defense. A lot of states even abolished it completely.
And he was just released recently, right? With, like, within the past couple of years, I think he actually was released.
Yeah, he was released a couple of years ago, but he is still being monitored by some sort of mental health, essentially parole board. And I think I could be wrong in this, but if he commits any sort of additional crime, his conditional release can be revoked.
So Hinckley is the exception to the rule.
Yes, not many people would have been successful, especially in something as big and publicly disliked as his crime was. So, in the case of Pauline and Juliet, their psychologists argue that not only was the girl's shared psychosis active at the time of the murder, but they opined that it prevented them from knowing that what they were doing was morally wrong. When defending their opinion, the psychologist cited the girl's sexual relationship, which, remember, both girls adamantly denied. They also referenced their inflated ideas about their own talent, intellect, and beauty. They talked about how the girls believed they had a telepathic connection with each other, that they often had mood swings, and they talked about a journal entry from Pauline's diary in which she wrote about finding a new spiritual world, AKA the fourth dimension. Both doctors were ripped to shreds during cross-examination. They both admitted, both Pauline and Juliet told them straight up that they committed the murder because they didn't want to be separated. They also both told the doctors that they knew murder was illegal and that it was wrong in the eyes of society. There was also errors in their interview notes. There was a lack of evidence supporting a sexual relationship, and the prosecution also mentioned both of the girls had a tendency to lie. In contrast, the prosecution had three psychologists, all of which had much more experience testifying in court, evaluate both girls. They all opined the girls knew murder was against the law and wrong. To support their opinion, they spoke about how the girls tried to pass the murder off as an accident. They told the evaluators that they planned the murder and knew it was wrong. The evaluators also believed that the girls' elevated self-perceptions and mood swings were just a part of normal adolescent development. The girls were found guilty of murder and sentenced to prison until the judge determined that they could be released. If they were adults, they would have been sentenced to death. But because they were juveniles, it was an indeterminate commitment until the magistrate said they could be released from prison. Hilda Hulme left for England a few days after the trial. She decided to leave because Juliet had continuously refused to speak to her, and during the course of the investigation, Bill Perry lost his job because of his connection with Juliet. And so they decided to just go to England because it would be easier for him to find a job, and that was their original plan to begin with. Juliet was sent to Auckland Prison. This was a jail that was built in the 1800s, and it was known for being dark, cold, wet, and infested with rats. While in prison, Juliet had a private violin tutor and continued her education. She worked in the garment factory. She also continued to write, but the girls were not allowed to write to each other. In early 1955, the divorce between Juliet's parents was finalized, and her father started dating a new woman that he would soon marry. Pauline was sent to a juvenile facility that had a specific focus on reform. The facility she was at was much better than Juliet's. There was actually a plan to switch them halfway through, but that never happened.
So Juliet, who was the person who was much more financially well off, actually ended up in the worst of the two facilities?
Yeah, she was actually sent to like the worst facility in New Zealand, which I also found interesting because Pauline was sent at one that was much nicer and the whole focus was basically on rehabilitation. When Pauline was first incarcerated, she really refused to interact with any of the other prisoners. She also treated staff poorly and refused to do any job assignments. She did continue to write in her diary, and she collected newspaper clippings about the murder of her mother, as well as photographs that depicted intense love scenes. She worked diligently on her schoolwork and was actually at one point allowed a day visit to a local university. Around this time, her mood changed and her social interactions improved. She was transferred to Christchurch Prison in August 1958. While there, she met with a psychologist regularly and was allowed more day visits to the local university to use the library. She also had regular visits with her family and family friends of the Humes. 2 months later, she was permitted weekend visits. Both girls were released from prison secretly in December 1958. It was several months until the public was told that they were released. Although there was nothing written in their release agreement preventing them from getting in touch with each other, they never spoke again.
In one of the interviews with Peter Jackson that I watched in preparation for this, he discussed that apparently part of the plan was to keep them separated. And that's why one was released 2 weeks later than the other one and was allowed to leave the country while the other one remained in New Zealand under probation and could not leave the country. So by his research, he said that they couldn't, I guess, officially keep them apart, but they did what they could to keep them apart, at least upon release.
Yeah, that makes sense. Upon release, Pauline changed her name to Hillary and obtained a bachelor's degree. She briefly tried to become a nun. She stayed in New Zealand for a while, as you said, because she was on probation, and she started working as a librarian. Her father rarely communicated with her. He essentially just could never get over the murder. But Pauline maintained a close relationship with both of her sisters. Juliet changed her name to Anne Stuart Perry and moved to England to be closer to her family. She was still interested in moving to Hollywood, but the murder conviction prevented her from obtaining a visa. However, 3 years later, she got a job with an airline, and at one of the layovers, she just got off the plane in California, got a job as a nanny, and got her visa a few years later. She returned to England in 1972 after her stepfather became ill. By 1978, she had published several novels, which were becoming increasingly popular in the United States and Germany. By 1994, she had sold more than 3 million copies of her books, and she signed a $1 million contract to author 8 more.
That is very impressive, actually.
Yeah, that's crazy. She was a very successful author.
Yeah, very unbelievable.
At the opening party for the film Heavenly Creatures, someone told a reporter that Pauline was working at a bookstore in New Zealand while Juliet was a writer with the last name of Perry living in Scotland. The reporter decided to track down both girls and write a story about them, even though Peter Jackson begged her not to. He did not want this movie to uproot their lives or bring any negative attention to these women who, for decades at this point, had been living relatively normal lives and their identities were completely unknown to the people around them.
In several interviews that I watched, Peter Jackson goes out of his way to protect the identities of these two women. All the interviews I watched are from 1994 when the film came out, but he is repeatedly asked where the girls are, what they are doing, and he clearly knows. I don't know if he actually contacted them or anything like that, but he definitely knew where the girls were and what they were doing, and he really wanted to protect that. He did not want these girls' lives to be impacted again, especially by this film coming out. It seemed very important to him that the girls' lives be respected.
I think that's one of the reasons why, even though I haven't seen the movie, like, I really respect it so much, because I feel like a lot of people would have tried to track them down to add a different flair to their movie.
I am very impressed with the way that Peter Jackson went about making this film, and especially after hearing the true story, just the amount of details that were thrown in casually to where you wouldn't even notice them, but he really paid attention to details, and this is clearly something that he was very passionate about.
So that reporter located Juliet pretty darn easily and promptly exposed her identity. After it was exposed, Juliet actually came out in public and said she was relieved that her identity was exposed and everyone she had spoke to was supportive of her. It probably helped that the revelation helped book profits. By 2006, she had sold 20 million copies of her books worldwide.
So it was quite the career boost coming out as who she really was.
She was already successful before that, but this just kind of blew her off the map.
Everybody wants to read a book by a murderer.
Exactly. In 2007, she agreed to participate in a documentary about her life. The documentary mostly contained footage of her day-to-day life living on a farm. When asked about the murder, she tearfully stated, "Mother was going with Bill. I was going to South Africa. When Pauline heard, her world fell apart. I really thought she would take her life. She had bulimia. She was throwing up after every meal. I know it was stupid. I felt trapped. I knew it was wrong. I knew it was stupid. I knew I would have to pay for it. I didn't see any other way. I couldn't go to my mother or father. I couldn't walk away. I did something stupid I'll regret for the rest of my life." What about Pauline? Well, a reporter contacted her in 1985, but she denied ever going by a different name. In 1997, her sister Wendy agreed to a press interview on Pauline's behalf with the condition that the reporters would leave Pauline alone. Wendy told the interviewer Pauline lived in a small village where no one knew her true identity. She was deeply religious and enjoyed her quiet life. Pauline ended up working at a school for youth with developmental disabilities for decades. She actually became the headmaster of the school. Once she retired, she purchased 11 horses and opened a horseback riding academy. Unfortunately, the reporters did not follow through with their promise to leave Pauline alone, and she ended up selling her land shortly after the article was published. The person who bought Pauline's home noticed a large mural painted all over the walls of her bedroom. And Remy, I have several pictures of the mural. You don't have to describe them all, but focus on the bottom one there.
I'm looking through the photos right now. There's several images of what appeared to be like winged knights with swords. There's someone in a birdcage of sorts and several horses, a lot of pegasuses. But at the bottom here, what you were referring to, there is what looks like two women together holding some sort of a streamer or banner, and they're together in a fire, and one is clearly a blonde and the other is clearly a brunette, which mirrors Juliet and Pauline's own hair colors.
Yeah, so after this mural was discovered, it kind of spawned rumors that even though both girls never spoke again, that the relationship they had was never far from Pauline's mind.
Sort of a tragic tale. I mean, two girls, very young. I can't speak for everyone, but I was not the most emotionally stable person as a teen. And it seems like these two girls had a very close bond. Every girl that I knew as a teenager had that one friend that they would ride or die for. The ones they were best friends, they were around all the time, joined at the hip. And this whole story really is about two very young girls who made horrible decisions, of course, but I can sympathize with these two girls. I've read a lot of true crime, I've seen a lot of documentaries, and I actually legitimately can understand where these two girls were coming from. I'm not saying it's right, but I understand it. I understand where your mind can be at that age, and to think that certain things are the end of the world, and to behave impulsively or irrationally, and as an adult, look back and know how truly misguided that sort of thing was.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great example of how premature cognitive development can lead teenagers to make awful choices, but it does not mean that they're going to grow up to be irredeemable and criminal adults. So after Pauline sold her home, she moved to a small town in Scotland. Another reporter located her in 2010, but she again denied being Pauline Parker. For years, the women lived less than 100 miles apart from each other in Scotland, but they never reunited. A fictional version of their reunion was turned into a play called Feuille d'Oie in 2010. And that is the true story of Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures. What do you think, Remy?
I think it is a amazing story and not what I initially expected. I honestly couldn't remember what the story was about when we had signed up to do this. And I had initially thought that it was about, like, a massacre. I thought these girls killed their entire families, basically. Needless to say, I was wrong, and I think the story is a much more human one. And I think it's a story that I can understand, and I can see where these girls were coming from. Again, doesn't make it right. I think it's a very interesting story.
I agree. I really liked reading about this. It had essentially everything that a forensic psychologist would want. It had murder. It had the insanity defense. It had shitty psychological experts that were clearly hired guns and were willing to say whatever the defense wanted. And I also find it interesting when crimes like this are committed by juveniles because it is a rarity.
I think we have finally reached that time. We have a rating system that we do. We've just done one film so far, and basically it goes like this. If we think the film is a accurate depiction, like dead on, got all the details, was a perfect adaptation of the true events, it gets a not guilty verdict from us. If we think that it got most of the stuff right, but still changed quite a bit, we're gonna rule it a mistrial. If they just flat out changed everything, and the story has little to no resemblance of the real life events, we are going to find the film guilty. So Ashley, what is your ruling in this film, Heavenly Creatures?
I'm gonna give this one a solid not guilty. I feel like Peter Jackson did a very good job, based on your description, adapting this story into a film depiction. I think that there were some changes made, which is always going to be the case, but I think the feel of it and the actual events and the meaning behind them were really stuck to as best as any movie could hope to do.
I totally agree. I would give this film a not guilty verdict as well. After hearing the true story behind everything, I was amazed at how much lined up perfectly. Peter Jackson did his homework with this one. He portrayed it in a creative way that was engaging and true to the real life events. So, not guilty.
Well, that's it for today. Please join us next week when we will be tackling Wes Craven's Scream, which I bet many of you did not know was based on a true story of the Gainesville Ripper.
I had absolutely no idea that this was based on a true story. I don't know anything about the true story. I have seen the film many times, but I'm looking forward to watching it again and to talking to you again next time.
And please, everyone, if you like what you hear, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe so we can get the podcast out there and continue bringing you episodes about your favorite true crime movies.
Thank you so much for joining us again. We will see you next time when we discuss Scream.
Bye-bye.